Revenue Committee, Mr. Malik, I didn't know you were doing excise taxes for us. Is that a new part of your portfolio?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is my new portfolio. They say I do excise taxes. Mary would be doing the property tax.
Oh.
We've kind of tumbled.
I see.
Responsibilities. I am youth new decades, although I wish I had the same 6'6 frame, but unfortunately that didn't work.
Me neither.
Yeah.
We should recognize and welcome Barbara. And I'm going to mispronounce your last name.
Gardino.
Gardino. She's been battling the flu, but is our committee administrator and got it, on Sunday, and is already back here by Tuesday, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, good recovery.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, welcome.
Good to meet you.
Thank you.
Paul, do we have anything? Or
The only thing we have, Mr. Chair, is Senator George off has called and said he is ill and won't be able to join us today.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
I'm getting very concerned about all this. I mean, I came down here with the idea of not being sick this year, and I don't like the stories I'm hearing. I think maybe we should consider adjourning for a couple of weeks until everybody's healthy.
Yeah, I guess Senator Cruz has got pneumonia.
Yeah. Really?
I just heard that this morning.
Yeah, he came into the elevator at 6:45 yesterday morning with Dr. Bates, and very quickly after that he went home.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, well, pneumonia.
Pneumonia. They reported to our caucus that he was seriously ill with pneumonia and it was very contagious, and so they thought he ought to be someplace else than here.
That was Monday morning.
That was yesterday morning.
Yesterday,
yeah,
Monday.
Tuesday, yeah.
Was it Wednesday?
Yeah.
Today is Wednesday.
We're right on top of things in Santa Rosa.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well,
time
good we got.
Flies when we're having fun.
Yeah, good we got that straightened out. Well, it seems to be going. Yeah, definitely these things come in spades, and it seems to be. So, talk to us about excise taxes and lowering our immune levels by smoking and drinking, and that'll be our segue into excise taxes.
Well, Mr. Chair, for the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. It's good to see you again. I'm probably the sole survivor of the Senate Revenue Committee. the first few days of this week, you've heard about all the tough and hard taxes and the big issues with the Oregon taxing system. They say I do excise taxes. I actually think of them as a fun taxes. And many people would say sin taxes, as you have led to them. But primarily the excise taxes that we will talk about. get the lights a little bit. You'll probably be able to see better. Tobacco tax, and then alcoholic beverages, telecommunications, fuel tax, and weight mile tax, and finally the new tax that we've started is the transient object tax. Now, the tobacco revenue would primarily be about three different types: the cigarette taxes, other tobacco products tax, and then the special master settlement agreement. Now, I'm trying all these special effects with these taxes in order to be able or try to keep tobacco taxes as lively as the issue could be. The cigarette tax rate have gone through time in different levels in Oregon. The first enactment of an excise tax on cigarettes was done by the Oregon legislature in July 1st of 1966. We've done at that time 4 cents per pack. A lot of people probably are familiar more with the more recent measures of Measure 44 in 1996 and Measure 20 in 2002. Measure 44 in 96, of course, was through initiative petition, and it increased the permanent rate to 58 cents, while Measure 20 increased it to an additional 60 cents. However, those different times, as we said, it was 6 cents enacted by the legislature here, and at that time the taxes were designed to be shared between the state and local governments on 50-50. Cities would get 25%, counties would get another 25%, and the idea of that was to allow for reduction in property taxes. Now, in 1971, and you would see it here, the tax went was to 9 cents, again by the enactment of the legislature, and in 1985, right here, you would have a 27 cents, and again in 89, which you would see as the fiscal year 90, because it started at that time, January 1st, it it went to 28 cents. Now, that leaves these 2 years to show for. This was a 7 cents temporary tax that was enacted but allowed to sunset in that time. In 1993, there was a 10 cents tax that was also a temporary tax that was to be sunset in July 1st, 1995, but it continued to be renewed every year until we had Measure 20 of, I'm sorry, we had Measure 30 last year. Basically, that one came as the referendum on the revenue package of the 2003 session. It included with it that 10 cents temporary tax, and it was accordingly reduced. Now, always a question comes when we talk about excise taxes: how does the state compare to other states? And when we're looking at the excise tax by themselves, Oregon is about number 11 in its ranking at $1.18 per pack. If we look at that in including the distinction, of course, of Oregon as an unsaved tax state, and we include other states' sales tax with the excise taxes, that ranking drops down to number 16. And emphasis on that. The 0304 revenues of cigarette taxes by themselves does not include all tobacco taxes, but $240.1 million. Now, remember that although the $240.1 million does not sound too much out of the general revenue for cigarette taxes, that amount was over 6 months at 128 cents and 6 months at 118 cents. So you would expect the later years to be slightly different than that amount. Then you have the distribution as it comes in the dedication at 75% at that time for the health plan, general fund 16, tobacco use reduction account is 3%, and local governments, that includes cities, counties, and transit, that goes through the transit districts for the disabled and elderly. Now, the distribution proportions kind of shift and change depending on how you look at the different programs and how you divide the different tax rates. Now, in the laws, we still have two tax rates on tobacco. The first one, what we call the permanent, at 58 cents, and it is divided in this way of 37, 46, 5 for Chora and local at 10.35. However, you will probably not see in the law that percentage per se. What you would see is all these three put together saying you send 89.65% to the general fund and the rest of 10.35 to locals. And from that point, the general fund starts sending to the health plan and tobacco reduction account. Also in the law, the 60 cents is divided differently from the 58 cents. And it's divided primarily for the health plan, but at 97.9, TORA at 0.7, and then the local government at 1.4. This was done in 01 and 03. These citation of laws basically show the distribution in which segment of the tax. If you put all these things, percentages together, you get to a picture of about 18.6 for the general fund, 72 for the health plan. Now remember, the temporary tax of the 10 cents that elapsed with Measure 30 was 100% dedicated to the health plan. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now,
hey Matt, is the health department or DHS administer the tobacco use reduction account?
The tobacco use reduction account, I think, is done by DHS.
DHS. Right. So they write the administrative rules and contract with the firms that would the ads. And
I'm not precisely sure how they administer it, but I could find out for you.
Okay.
But they, once you put that 100% of the 10 cents into the formula, you would see that the we go back to the 70, almost 74.8 or 75% going to the health plan, and that's how we saw the 03, 04 distribution that might not come again in the same way because of the elapse of those 10 cents. Now, cigarette revenue forecast, that's what it would show, how we will find the slight reduction in the coming biennium. At 05, 07, we're looking at $447.7 million. That's, as you could see, 325.3 OM going to the health plan, and the rest is divided between the general fund and the other accounts. Now, you would probably could easily distinguish the effects of the different measures. Now, remember in the 01-03 biennium with the Measure 20 of 2002, that wasn't fully phased in, but it has about 6 months or so into the 01-03, and that's why that you don't see this huge jump between 01-03 and 03-05. However, this basically is when Measure 20 of the 60 cents fully phased in. That was the first biennium. Now, that reduction is including the 10 cents. There's about 6 months of the biennium, the 03-05, that does not include that 10 cents. Remember, it elapsed in January. but the 05-07 will have the full 10 cents reduction and perhaps would have other reductions according to the what we see as the smoking reduction in general that we see. Now, when we're going to look at cigarette tax and population figures and look at what is smoking consumptions have been, because that basically tells us what we can expect. The tax distributions, unfortunately, would only look at the tax cigarette packs that we could tax and we could collect a tax on. And it is pretty evident that there was a time when a big drop happened, that's about the 82-83. In that year, that is consistent with the national statistics. If you look at all smoking in the United States, it have peaked in 82, was the highest ever that we smoked as a nation, and then it made this huge drop in the years after that. It bounced back a little bit, and then it started back into a sliding and reducing scale. And just to give you some sense of that, in 1982-83 in Oregon, we would smoke at the rate of 145 packs per capita per year. Okay. Today, we're looking at about 50 packs per capita per year. That is about 63% drop if you look at these statistics. And that's in the total volume. Now, remember, the population, of course, have also increased. So when we're talking per capita, that might dilute the issue. But that's only 35% increase in population. So if you take the same number, if you will, of packs here and the same number of population that was then, instead of 50 packs per capita, you're talking about 75 packs per capita. That is still down from 145 packs. That is a significant reduction. Of course, economists will not only see reductions without looking at elasticity and price, and we think that price is an important thing. And in comparison, we see how price of cigarettes and CPI and how they compare. And if you take at this point where they probably were equal and go on, you would see that the price for cigarettes is probably twice the amount of increase as the price of the general goods and services in the economy, which confirms at least to the followers of the discipline that price makes a difference. Well, with cigarettes are done, we do other tobacco products. Now, the other tobacco products are a whole bunch of things, including cigars, snuff, smoking.
You can't officially smoke during this section. Senator Metzger has a cigar. So this is the only time we allow smoking in the capitals when we get our tobacco reports.
Well, the unfortunately, smoking the cigars will not help the cities and counties. However, it will be for the health plan. So there is a good duty out of smoking cigars after all. Don't feel too bad about it. The cigars or the other tobacco product have seen only twice in 85 and in 97 change. Other tobacco products at about 65%, that's a tax rate, 65% of wholesale price. However, the tax on cigars is capped or limited at about 50 cents per cigar. That's the highest that you could go. Now, why is that? It's probably because going beyond the 50 cents would push cigar prices too much and make them smell even worse. 03-04 revenues, that's for other tobacco products, about $25.3 million. And that's a comparison between cigarettes and the other tobacco, you would see that the other tobacco is not as large as cigarette taxation. Now, the interesting thing about this chart is having the general fund, the health plan, CHORA, those are the dedications in the law. However, because of the way the what we know now as the compliance, tobacco compliance task force was established and funded in the 03 session, it got in the law 3.3.625 a $10 million funding through the other tobacco revenue. That is compared with death forecast. If above and beyond the death forecast, the first $10 million of those will go to fund the compliance task force. And that's why you find this big chunk that obviously means that the other tobacco product is bringing a lot more than the DAS forecast had for other tobacco products, which in essence is we probably will get to about 10 million in the 03-05, and most of that will be in the funding for the enforcement tobacco products.
I have a question for you because I didn't see it in the upcoming slides. So when we change the taxation on cigars to the flat, you know, max 50 cents, I think that was that 01 or 99?
But it
was
99.
99. Mm-hmm. So have you done a calculation in terms of what the other tobacco products, specifically cigars, what in terms of revenue, what impact that change has made on collection of taxes? I mean, is it, you know, in comparison since that law took effect?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, if we're thinking about what would have been generated if it was 65% of...
Well, no, because that's a different question.
Oh.
Because that, you know, that could affect purchasing habits. But in terms of actual revenue, and, you know, prior to passage of that bill, and now... I remember the arguments, you know, that you would, well, people won't be buying on the internet now because it's not worth it, and therefore they'll buy more locally, et cetera. I'm just curious, in terms of total revenue, have we been able to track the difference between what happened prior to passage of that bill and now that it's been implemented for 4 or 5 years?
Senator Metzger, the numbers in the revenue side that I've looked at does not seem to suggest that there is a big drop in the revenue numbers. However, the most telling story, if you will, is coming out of the tobacco enforcement. That has really gone up. What does it suggest, as we heard from the different tobacco task force discussions, that there has been a lot of neglected payments, if you will.
And
by the way, the Tabasco Task Force funding and existence in the law does elapse in the 2008 that is prescribed in law. So is that going to leave a long-lasting effect? That remains to be the question. Did it? Did the increasing the tax devastate cigar consumption? It does not seem to be the case as the numbers that we have looked at.
Right. Again, Mr. Chair, too, one of the things that I think may have gone on with the jump we saw last year in other tobacco, as well as the task force, is with Measure 20, you had a sharp increase in cigarette prices, but not a corresponding increase in other tobacco. So unlike Measure 44, which increased them both, Measure 20 increased the price of cigarettes relative to other tobacco. Mm-hmm. So we may have had some substitution going on.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah. I think that's interesting because, as I recall those arguments, we can't tell definitively just from the numbers, although the numbers certainly do not argue against that. I mean, they, you know, we have not seen a radical drop, you know, because of that price, because I remember one of the arguments was that if people were buying on the internet, they weren't paying any taxes at all and taking, you know, local business away, and that if we had, say, the 50-cent level, that people would be more inclined to go to Rich's and buy a cigar than the internet. And the other argument was, no, it's just going to reduce revenue, but certainly the revenue has not declined, which at least superficially would seem to support the argument that it wasn't going to have a deleterious effect on revenue. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, black markets are a function of many things, and if we're talking about somewhere where profit exists outside the confines of a certain laws, theory says that somebody will try to take advantage of it, and that's where black markets start existing, in that outside kind of place. Now, how big and how much and how effective is it, and how effective regulations are in reducing the size of the black market, that is still in the black box. I don't think we have a full handle on how much that is.
And Representative Butler, I believe, in the House is interested in this issue in terms of just that issue of working with the Department of Revenue in terms of tracking. So we may see some bill come towards us in this regard, in this respect.
Mr. Chair, if we one of the points in putting the different tobacco, cigarette or other tobacco in together in the mix, will show again the point that the distributions to the different places changes every time you put a different layer of distributions in the denominator. Remember the talk about the 58 cents and the 60 cents and how much to the Oregon health plan. Other tobacco only goes to the health plan and the general fund, which changes the percentages again because the denominator is about the same and the distribution is. So you could see how this area now exists, although it goes through the different issues. The general fund is slightly going down. However, those slivers of revenue for the different programs still go about the same. The Master Settlement Agreement, and I understand there is probably a lot of interest on this issue. It's about 47 states. Attorney General sued cigarette manufacturers. Four of them, or the big ones, became what known to be the original participating, and that's about 96-97% of the total, and then subsequent and non-participating. And part of the settlement was to enact certain laws to govern how the non-participating get into the agreement and so on. But the bulk of the agreement is about an annual payment and perpetuity, and that's never to end, basically, subject to certain adjustments. Those adjustments, some of them are on the upside, and others are on the downside. The upside is price and so on. You would adjust accordingly. However, market share, if that changes within the domestic market, and amounts of revenue, that will bring down the payments for the agreement. And it seems, with all the other things held equal, the lower pressures on the payments are stronger than the up pressures on the payments. Now, how these payments are going to occur? At a certain time, we looked at the original estimates, and those have not changed by much at this point. But from the start of the promises and discussions, which was in 99, up to the end of the 02 fiscal year, 6/30/02, those initial payments are the national payments. Oregon share of these payments are about 1.13%. I'm sorry, 1.15 of these payments, at about 257.6 a year. Well, I'm sorry. This is total from 99 until the year 2000. It will be about 81 a year or 70 million some a year from that point on. Or 2 or 3, we're looking at 81.4. And then at a certain time in the year 2007, the other segment, which is the strategic payment, kicks in, and that brings the total payments to about 93.5. There was in the year 2000, Measure 89, legislative referral, and Measure 4, initiative petition, to try to dedicate those payments of the master settlements. Both of these measures failed. And most of it is an appropriation. Now, these payments come and have been used in different ways, and I'm trying to put this chart in a way it might be a little more complicated than I tried to do, but let me try to explain quickly here. Until the 6/30/2003, that's the end of the 01-03 biennium. Total revenue received under the agreement was $338 million, and there was about $9.3 in interest and investment that came from the account that was held by the Treasury into and invested. Now, the in that time, about 211 went to OMAP, Oregon Medical Assistance Program, and after that it became the Oregon Health Plan. General fund insurance and health and balance took about $125 million, so we ended up with about 10.2 in balance. That, you could see, most of it is coming from the amounts of interest and investment. In the 03-05, the expectation is about $144 million. That's about 72 some a year. The amounts that we find in the budget proposals, about 42.2 for the health plan, 41.8 will pay for the Oregon appropriation bonds. These are the bonds of last session, the 2003, or some would say the sixth special session. Those bonds were $450 million. The payments for them, however, did not, because they were not sold until the end of the biennium, the payments did not, or does not start until later in time. So you find only 41.8 payment, and that's primarily 1.5 or 1.25 payment rather than 2 full payments on the bonds. Same thing you would find, the same story with the OHSU debt series, and 46.3 for other programs. That leaves a balance of 61.5. And as you would see later on, that the payments for the $450 million are structured with the same way where the strategic payment comes in. The payments go up, but in general they're about 86.7 or 87, about 41, $42 million a year on the payments of the $450 million bonds. Then the second series of what so-called the 2003 OHSU debt, that's the $103 million series, starts kicking in, and that's both of them, each of about $15 million payment a year, a biennium, I'm sorry. So the $450 million gets to this point, and after that, it's paid off. It's only 10 years, $450 million, that how it was structured in the 2003 session. However, the OHSU debt takes slightly longer. By the time in 2023, 2024, we're debt-free from that obligation, at least. The numbers I have in double brackets here is just trying to estimate. They probably will not find them anywhere. And the what we have seen previously of it, of expenditures on the health plan, and that also corresponds to the same idea as what you would have left, plus the balance that we've seen before. Now that we have muddled those waters, and let's quit smoking and go to alcohol.
Sir Metzger, do you have now a beer to put on the table?
No, I'm not a beer.
Not a beer drinker.
Well, beer, maybe wine.
Okay. Yeah, that.
And if your pleasure is hard liquor, distilled spirits, that's also goes under the patriotic duty of each Oregonian to do, because you will be funding vital programs, as they would say. Now, let's start with beer tax. 1933, it was the first time we've seen tax on beer at $1 per barrel of 31 gallons. That, I don't know how many times you go to your favorite drinking place and ask for a barrel of beer, but if it's in gallons, it's about 3.22 cents per gallon. Today, we're about 8.38 cents per gallon. Now, again, I don't know how many go and get a gallon of beer to drink, but if in the sense of what a six pack of beer or a bottle of beer would be, a gallon, remember, is 128 fluid ounces. Six pack would be about 4.7 cents. That's less than 5 cents per six pack. A 12 ounce bottle, that's a normal size, I think, would be about 0.786 of a cent. Now, depending on your drinking habit, if you sip at the rate of an ounce and a half per sip, you'll be paying about 0.098 of a cent, or about 10% of a penny for each sip that you have of beer. Remember. Now, I did not show this slide when I did this presentation to the House Revenue Committee. Paul Romaine stopped me in the halls and said, you know, I need to show the state tax comparison only with excise, not excise plus sales. Now, Oregon would drag number 48, but when you put the sales tax with the other states, Oregon would be number 51. 51 because we have the District of Columbia in.
So we have the lowest beer taxes in the nation.
This is beer heaven of the nation, Mr. Chair, so we might as well enjoy it.
Which is appropriate, I think. Yeah.
Now, the 0304 beer tax revenues, about $6.7 million. They distribute into 50% to mental health, 28% general fund, counties get 5%, and cities get 17%. I'm sorry. The beer tax revenue through time have slightly gone up, probably commensurate with the tax rate that we have seen in the previous slide. The distribution have not changed that much, but the as we talked about tax of cigarettes, the per capita beer consumption has, in if you look at 87, this time we were drinking about 23.05 gallons per capita per year.
Hey, Matt Mazin?
Yes, sir.
And perhaps, and I know that this would be a future slide that we could look at, but if you could tease out of the two prior slides. The producer states, maybe the top 10 producer states, and then those without, and compare us to our fellow producer states, and then those without a sales tax, too. So the states that don't have a sales tax, and just see how we kind of fit in with that grouping. I think that would be interesting comparison for us.
We'll do, Mr. Chair. So you want the producer states and the drinker states. Okay. Now, as far as drinking goes, as I was saying, in 1990, we increased drinking to about 23.67 gallons per capita. That translates into about 42 six-packs a year per capita. If you have not done your 42 six-packs a year, somebody else is drinking your six-packs.
Last session we had Senator Corcoran on the committee, and he helped carry our average for us.
The 2004 is about 22.35, so we've went somehow up, but we're there. That's about, again, 39.7 six-packs. The wine tax rates, now we're done with beer, we'll go to something that people might prefer. The wine tax is although the same, but primarily it's distinguishes between two kinds, the 14% alcohol or less, or the table wine, and then the dessert wine, 14 to 21%. 67 cents is the rate for the table wine, and 77 cents is the rate for the dessert wine. And you could see at certain times not both were taxed. Or the tax that was here in 37 was allowed to elapse. And other times taxes were reduced on wine. So the wine on tax did not necessarily go through the same trends that we have seen with other sin taxes, if you will. If you, again, want to look at where we rank, Oregon, when it comes to state wine taxes, we're about 23. However, if you put that with the sales tax of the other states, what we've come to at this point, we drop down to about 47. That's a large slide.
Do you know which are the other, we know California and Washington are other big producer states. Do you know, or I don't know, Gary, if you know, what are the other big producer states for wine?
This chart shows you the sales tax. One before it shows you the comparing the taxes on the wine.
Uh-huh. It's New York.
But I think... I'm not sure Indiana does any wine, Mr. Chair, but... when last time I was there, they gave me a bottle of Indiana wine, and I was really surprised. So it seems like it's becoming more of a thing to do.
Yeah.
However, not necessarily as big of a volume as California would do, or Oregon.
Texas even has a few vineyards now.
Do they really?
Yeah.
So the climate is?
Irrigation. Out in West Texas. I know that's where some of it, and I think some of it's now in the valley.
Huh. I guess, yeah.
Jalapeno.
Jalapeno. It's our favorite.
No, 304 wine tax revenue, about $6.96 million. That includes both kinds. Now, the wine distribution is slightly different than the beer distribution, or revenue distribution. Mental health gets 49% rather than 50, and everybody gets slightly less because we're funding the wine board with about 3% of the revenue that comes from wine. And Winetax Avenue, a quick history that we have here. And as I said before, I tried to use this burgundy to indicate table wine and the more sweet color for the more sweet wine. Again, on the wine tax, as we did with the other ones, what we were drinking in 87, and this time here where you have it at the high level, we were drinking about 3.2 gallons per capita per year. In 95, or in this area here, we're drinking 2.23 gallons per capita. In the year 2000, as well as estimates for probably 2004, we're drinking 2.58. Now, remember, there is an increase in rate here, so not all this reflects, and this is revenue, not all of it reflects increased consumption, but we have 2.58 per capita per year. And if you compare that to 1987, we have dropped actually about 19.4% in consumption.
Do we know when Oregon started production of wines?
Just 70s?
Okay.
When did the Ponzi's?
I think maybe 60s, but probably 70s is when we know.
That'll be a failed hearing.
It seems like the drop of 19% would suggest that, regardless to what it would be suggested, that as we become more sophisticated, we drink more wine, it seems like beer is still the king in Oregon. The OLCC liquor markup is primarily on hard liquor and distilled spirits. Markup is set by the commission, the OLCC, and that is vested in law by ORS 471.745. Officially, they set the markup on liquor as it comes. Today, it is about 106%. That's the markup of as it comes through the door. Now, that haven't changed in years, but the more you would find costs of stores and distribution and so on, you would find that that markup is around and dropping about 101%. Okay. Now, all of CC sales, these are probably the more OLCC sales are the more profitable for the OLCC, and we find here again in cases, that's the red, the sales that will go higher because of the markup and price, of course, because those are just dollars and they go faster, and then your population. And what that suggests, again, for the numbers to compare, and at this point in 87, we were drinking about 1.45 gallons of hard liquor per capita per year. Today, of 95, we went to about 1.21. We started going back up in 2000 to 1.28 gallons per capita, and in 03 and 04 we're about 1.33%. That's a drop, but it's only 8% drop. Now, I have a if I have a family of four, that means 1.33 I need to be drinking four times that in order to catch the average. This is my family of four, by the way. this is in our the summer trip to Egypt. You see the pyramids behind us.
I thought that was tigered.
Well, We drink in Tiger, but they pay taxes there.
But they go to the rock climbing taxation.
That's a new rock climbing wall.
And this is in response to your request, Mr. Chair, that we include the picture of the kids here. When you saw Elizabeth's child yesterday. So, who's drinking my family chair?
You're not going to answer that for
us. Not at this point, but I do my part. I don't think I come that close.
Just take your camera down to McGo's, and that can be your answer to that.
Well, I'm afraid you, Mr. Chair, to find out that I am drinking my fifth year of this. The OLCC revenues, as you would see, is $304 million. This is probably the largest bulk that you could see coming from the OLCC. Cost of the general sales is about 48%, privilege for net sales 35%. Now, the distribution formula for all the revenues that come in through OLCC go through two steps, if you will. First, out of the wine tax, you take that 2 cents of both the 67 cents or the 77 cents to the wine board. That was a 1984 establishment. And then you put the balance of that wine tax revenue into the privilege tax account. You distribute 50% of that to mental health, and the 50% goes to the OLCC big pot distribution. That gets the other OLCC revenue, which is the hard liquor and so on, and then it divides as 56% to the general fund, 10% to counties by population, 20% to cities by population, and then 14% to cities by formula. That's a 1977 law. So every time we drink wine, beer, and liquor, we're supporting our cities and our counties, as well as mental health programs, which makes one feel probably a little better about this thing. The distribution in total, if we put all these taxes together, we're about $119 million in 2003-04. If we look at those two parts, and after all that distribution and put them together, we're looking at 52.7 for the general fund, counties getting 9.4, cities about 32%, mental health 5.6, and the wine board is 0.2. A very tiny slice of the institution. Just to get a historical reference on how that happens from, if you look at that increase, truly is an increase of about 75%. And that's due to rate increases and population increases. That's enough with smoking and drinking. And once you do that, most likely you would be more of a need of a 911 emergency access tax than otherwise. In 81, quickly, that would be a 3% of access charges on telephones, 5% in 91, and that was a temporary arrangement. However, in 95, that was established in law of 75 cents per month per circuit. Circuit would include also a cell phone and anything that gets out. The revenue for the 911, as you would see, it have escalated through the years just because of those changes in the tax structure that we have seen.
So this is something that I know Representative Patrick did a lot of work on last session and the previous session, but something I'm interested in is you've seen a real precipitous growth in this 911 fund from 1993 to 2003, and I think it's worth looking into how that fund has grown and is all the calls on it that we placed in back what in 95, is there available money, frankly, to use for other purposes? I don't know if you have a breakdown of the fund. But at some point, I think we should, as a committee, should look at that and look at the fund itself and what's in it, and maybe have the folks who are benefiting from the fund come in and talk about how they're using the resources that they have.
Mr. Chair, I don't have immediately, but we could work on getting that and seeing about the users, arrange something with it. Now, I think most of the increase occurred because of this explosion of use of phones and cell phones. I mean, that is, once I used to have one phone, and now in my family that is five.
Mm-hmm.
More phones than family members. But I'm sure it's probably correct with many of them.
So it'd be interesting to see. I know the fund, how much is sitting, and I know it's appropriated out to the special service districts that administer it, but how much is sitting there and how much is being drawn out of that fund? And I know Representative Patridge, because he had some proposals around this, has done some of that work, but I certainly have that interest of, is there available resources within that fund that are going underutilized?
Mr. Chair, that was looked at pretty intensely in the special sessions, as you recall, and we'll get some of that information together.
Okay. No, Mr. Chair, finally, the dedications in the law that exist is for the regional 911 centers and the emergency response state and so on. So that would be for what they use it. Now, finally, we have fuel taxes or transportation taxes, gasoline tax. We are taxing gasoline, and this is if it's used as a fuel to propel a motor vehicle, that's a 24 cents per gallon tax. If it's not used to propel a motor vehicle, it's not either taxed, or the tax that is being paid on that goes to the what's so-called the right or appropriate uses. So if it is a tax that is being paid but used, let's say, by boats, or used by ATVs, or used by snowmobiles, used by lawnmowers, these taxations do not go to transportation, but they go to their appropriate uses, but they're still taxed. However, if you don't use it for propelling any of these vehicles, you could conceivably, the last few years, you could actually get a rebate on your taxes.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Pisanski,
can I ask for clarification in the sense of, let's say you have it for a lawnmower, to get the benefit of not having it taxed at the level for motor vehicles, the user has to do some type of rebate, is what I'm hearing, is you have to account for the number of gallons that you are using in this other means besides use for a motor vehicle or aircraft?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, that's correct. In the past, that was not the case. If you would have asked me this question about 5 years ago, the answer was no. Now there has been established a mechanism by which if you are using it for your rototiller or leaf blower or lawnmower, you could actually apply through the fuel tax group and get a refund. And if you don't, that amount of money would go into what's called the operation fund, or not operation fund, or lovingly known as the lawnmower fund.
Right. I've heard of that term.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Aircraft propulsion is different, two types. Aviation fuel, that's in the less sophisticated aircraft, and jet fuel at 1 cent. then diesel, CNG, which is compressed natural gas, and etc. That's a new fuel, just like the cell fuel, and etc. fuel. They're also, if they're used for the same purpose of propelling a motor vehicle, that's about 24 cents. However, diesel is used overwhelmingly by trucks, and trucks are not to pay the fuel tax because they pay the weight mile tax. Those are trucks over 26,000 pounds. So that arrangement is different on the taxation. Now the flat fees are a vehicle of what are called optional payments for the weight mile payments. And those flat fees are currently under challenge with court cases of their appropriateness. And then the road use assessment fees, we'll talk about them a little bit more. These are for what's called the indivisible loads. Those are the huge loads that you cannot divide into more 80,000 chunks, if you will. Just as you remember, at one point they had to truck the spruce goose through. That's you cannot divide it, or if you have a large crane that you need to have it on. You do take it, but you pay the road use assessment fees.
So for biodiesel fuel, if it's being used to propel a vehicle, it would also have that 24 cent tax.
That's correct.
If the vehicle was on the road vehicle.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. As compared to a farm vehicle.
As opposed to my diesel tractor.
Right.
Farm vehicles get it, and off road are not. If it's a diesel, the interesting thing, of course, that you don't pay on diesel tax as you would pay on gas tax. Gas tax is taxed from the distributor level, so there is no way that you could go to the service station and get gas that is not taxed. But that's not the same case with diesel. You don't pay the tax in many places, but probably not at your Chevron or so on. Many places you could find diesel that is not taxed.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes the onus on the user to establish an emblem number with the fuel tax and pay the tax if they are not using it on the big trucks. The big trucks that do pay the weight mile don't pay. And the allowance in this is just because primarily you need to make that distinction between the weight mile payers and the gas payers. Now, in the farm trucks, many farm trucks get their diesel untaxed to start with, and they use it probably on the uses and functions of the farm, and those are not taxed because they're not on a public highway.
Different color fuel, same product but with color added.
Mm.
And it's the same fuel exactly that goes into the furnace tank as well.
Right, there's many uses for the fuel that, you know, that the nuances become a little different. And if we go back, Mr. Chair, to the times that we have instituted the different motor vehicle fuel tax and increased rates, you would see that the last time that happened was in 1993. There was at that time, if you remember, the what's so-called the 2 cents per year type of increase. I put this chart with what's so-called Real 24. This is the real is in $2,000. In the year $2,000, and just capital 9 use it to make sure there is this difference in looking at tax rate. Fuel tax revenues in millions of dollars, you would see with the previous chart of the tax rate, you would see how this increase commensurate with that change here in 93, and you would see this in 95. When you had the less than the full increases in fuel tax. This is when fuel or gasoline became 24 cents. That's 345.9 or 346 million started generating. Now, since then, you would see an increase that is probably part of our population increase and VMT and so on. However, it gets to this point and we start seeing that this was the peak at this point. And now it's starting to come slightly down. Last year it was 385. In the past, I always observed that although many things that were happening, the MPG for the miles per gallon for the fleet was not really increasing that much. I think with the new introductions of what's called the hybrid vehicles and adding the power to the new hybrid, so you have both gas saving and horsepower, if you will, just like the new Accord, the V6 Honda Accord, where it's the most powerful Honda Accord with 265 horsepower and at the same time gives you 50 to 60 miles per gallon. I think that would probably start showing us a decrease in consumption as we time. But for the most part, you would say not too elastic. However, the weight mile taxes have a little different feel to them. Weight mile taxes go to basically two main segments. Table A, we call it, which is all 26 to 80,000 pounds. Remember, the 80,000 pounds is a demarcation point for trucks because that's the bulk of the trucks. So the weight mile taxes are graduated based on weight. Now, the weight is the primary determinant in the tax because the weight is supposedly what makes a difference on pressure on pavements and bridges and so on. The tax rate is 0.3 or 3 mils per mile for 26,000 pounds. Mils is 1/10 of a penny. And that also occurs, by the way, in cigarette tax, where the cigarette tax is 29 mils per cigarette. So mils is common used within the statutes. And it gets to about 11 cents, almost 12 cents per mile at the 80,000 pounds. Then you get to Table B, which is the higher level of weights, if you will. And the higher level of weights start changing, graduated on the weight of the axles, meaning how many axles you put on the truck, and because that reduces the damage. And then the in-lieu fees, which is the flat fees, the log sand, gravel, and chip trucks, and they had a different arrangement because the ease of payment that was when it started, ease of payment and ease of program. As I mentioned before, this is under legal discussion at this point.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I just want to follow up. I know we got Table A and Table B. I understand that there are rigs now that have higher weights than the 105.5, like up to 120. Are those special permitted on taxing? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, that yes, they have. After that level, you would get the what comes in as the road use assessment fees.
Okay, thank you.
If you put this in a chart, this would be your normal Table A payments. However, once you get to the 80,000 pound level, and if you start adding more axles into your truck, you basically get a reduced rate because reduced pressure on pavement means you need to, and there is a reward, if you will, a reward system of distributing the weight more and therefore paying less tax.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Another thing that's been brought to my attention is regarding not only the number of axles, but the number of wheels that are on the axle, and that some trucks are now using a wider tire instead of doing duals on each side. And I wonder if that's ever been looked at or discussed.
Not nowhere in terms of... Oh, that's interesting.
Mr. Chair, the I mean, these determinations are based primarily on engineering studies, ASHTO, and they're able to nuance these issues if the differences exist, which as far as the evidence we have seen or substantiated, the axles are what makes the difference. Now, how the configuration of the axle itself, I can't be that technical in telling you. The flat fees quickly, the log trucks pay 610 per hundredweight, farm trucks at 5, dump trucks, and then chip trucks 24.6. Road use assessment fees, that's 5.7 cents per easel, which is an equivalent single axle load per mile. And the easel, which is the term that probably comes back again at the time when you see the highway cost responsibility study, it is a relationship between the how much each easel gets in pounds. So you start making an equivalent poundage to each single axle load. And that's determined again by the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. But that's 1962, and it has been established, I guess, to that since that point that it really have not changed much. Okay, well, we've taken you through transportation. We have to house you for the night somewhere. Well, we haven't done yet this. Okay, last thing I want to say about the marine mine tax. If you remember, the fuel tax revenue that was going and continued on going started going down this way. If you would notice how the weight mile tax have a different contour to it, and that you would see is consistent with the recession that we have experienced. The trucking industry, hauling goods and so on, is a lot more sensitive to the recession and a lot more sensitive to personal income and changes in the economy than the less elastic fuel tax. So now we're going to put you in a room to sleep. The transient lodging tax is a product of the 2003 session. This is a new tax. This was House Bill 2267. And in general, it just puts 1% on the tax on rooms and so on. Department of Revenue administers this and gets a maximum collection cost of 2%, transmits it to the Tourism Commission. Tourism Commission basically funds the state and regional marketing programs and so on. However, we allow the lodging providers to collect about 5% for their troubles, if you will, in collecting the tax. Limits also the tax design by itself as it starts in January and transmits quarterly. It limits new local taxes to the local taxes to be tourism related. That's the, as you probably remember, the compromise with local governments that occurred last session. Transient lodging tax, the revenue estimates that LRO, Legislative Revenue Office, had last session for this. So we had 03-05 at about 16.5 million, growing in 05-07 to about 20 million.
Is it going to come in on target? Do we know?
Well, the thing that we know is in the first quarter, there's only been one quarter where you could actually have actual revenues. there has been a start first. The start of collecting the tax was and always is not as efficient and as smooth as one would encounter with a tax that has been going on for 10 or 15 years. So who pays, which is subject to tax and what's not subject to tax, in addition to the mechanism, who's going to collect, these things were probably not that clear for the process itself. But we still got 1.6 million. Now, that's taking out the 7% of the collection costs and so on. You're looking around 1.72 a quarter, allowing for 8 quarters in a biennium. That gives you about 13.76 million.
It's a little over, no, a little under.
But if you adjust for the conditions and difficulties of the program and who pays and who doesn't and these issues, I think it is still a reasonable estimate. And why you say that is if we look at the different transient lodging taxes within the state and the local government places and so on, it's an average rate of about 8%. And when that happens and you generate about 65.5 million per year, and not all jurisdictions do tax accordingly, but at the 8%, you're talking about 8.2 million for each percent. So at 8.2 million each percent, 2 years, you're talking about 16 million. In addition, that you have a wider blanket as a state tax rather than those
little municipalities.
Right. Mm-hmm. So with that, we think it is still a reasonable estimate. It might be slightly high, but the adjustments, I think, will catch up with it. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think we've given you a cigar and given you a drink.
I don't see any cigars.
Well, in theory, at least. And then we took you around in a tour and put you in a room.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think this has been a fascinating presentation, and especially because we now have the perfect profile of the typical Oregonian that I'm sure the marketing campaign, the Oregon marketing campaign, right, used, that we can now tell the world that a typical Oregonian smokes 165 packs of cigarettes a year, consumes six packs of beer, or 39.76 packs of beer a year, 2.58 gallons of wine a year, and 1.33 gallons of liquor a year. And, you know, I mean, it gives you a whole different perspective of the typical Oregonian, doesn't it?
Come and visit.
Yeah.
Party down.
Also, thank you for that.
That's why we love Dreamers.
Drinkers.
Oh, that's right. Dreamers. Maybe we should. Yeah. That's actually not a bad idea. Probably be a little more effective if we just said...
But yet after all that drinking, there is no doubt that we will be dreaming.
Our hallucination.
Yeah.
One actual question. Could you, on car rental, I got to ask the question yesterday. I don't know if you can give us, and this fits into the category of just maybe we'll have you back at when we do corporate or just a refresher on some of these slides, but something on car rental, maybe a slide on what Oregon has in place in terms of car rental, being a non-sales tax state. Do we have any... local, or I know there's a couple local taxes on car rentals. Is there anything going on? It'd be good to do a scan of that.
Mr. Chair, actually, we do. Multnomah County does. It has a tax on car rentals. And if one would think about the car rental capacity or the fleet of car rentals within the state, having the airport in the county and most of the population center, the Multnomah County probably captures a lot of the car rental business, if you will. There's some in the bigger cities, probably in Salem and so on.
What I'd be interested in looking at is maybe just Washington, California, and just looking at the comparative, because obviously visitors are going to be those who primarily rent cars. So just how do we compare maybe to our border states, California,
both adding their sales tax in and you know, looking at with sales and without sales, how does, when one of us goes down to Los Angeles or to Seattle, what's the freight we're paying versus what a visitor to Oregon would pay, both with the sales or if they come into Eugene without.
Can we expand that to all of the border states? Because I'd like to see Idaho.
Sure.
Something that's more to our size of population.
That's what Idaho does, too. Yeah,
yeah, Nevada. Good. I mean, the other.
Or maybe Utah. Or yeah, it'd be interesting to see just on. I got asked that question yesterday, and it's being a non-sales consumption state, it'd be interesting to look at that and see what other states are doing around car rentals and what they're raising, too. I mean, that would be better thing to see how much they raise off that.
I know, Mr. Chair, that we have numbers, at least for Oregon, and we could probably work on the bordering states and get some kind of a feel of what we
have. Yeah, it'd be interesting who's the most comparable. I don't know if Seattle, Tacoma, it's a little bit bigger, about a third bigger. It'd be just interesting to know kind of comparables and what kind of revenue that they're deriving from whatever they do or don't do. I'm not really sure.
Each state, of course, poses a different set of challenges. I mean, Nevada's with the gambling.
Right.
We have that, too. Not as much, of course. And Seattle, much bigger city. And
commerce.
A lot more commerce.
That's true. That's
Idaho
true.
Is a different,
different
economy. California is the sixth largest economy in the world.
Very good point. It's like, who's our most comparable on that in this... maybe Utah. I don't know. We're bigger than Utah is.
Utah has the least percentage of smoking and drinking in the United States, Mr. Chin. That does not compare with our average.
Yeah. I'm just thinking on the car run.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. I know what I have to throw.
Or Colorado, yeah. Other thoughts or areas of interest for Mr. Malik? Thank you. Appreciate the time and the discussion of our exercise. Actually makes us want to exercise. Come through that.
Thank you.
We are adjourned to do property taxes tomorrow.